Between client meetings, managing your business, and everyday tasks, who has time to worry about website hosting? With Kinsta's Managed WordPress hosting, you don't have to. They handle the technical stuff, delivering lightning-fast load times, enterprise-grade security, and 24/7, 365 human-only support. Simply switching to Kinsta can make your site up to 200% faster. Kinsta's custom dashboard makes managing sites easy, with powerful features designed to save you time and effort. Plus, their free expert-led migrations ensure a smooth transition. Ready to see why Kinsta is trusted by thousands of businesses? Get your first month free at kinsta.com. That's KINSTA.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
Axis Mundi.
Welcome to One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew L. Seidel, a constitutional attorney and the author of The Founding Myth and American Crusade. This is a podcast about religion, the law, and the battle for America's soul. We'll be separating church and state, defending freedom and equality, and fighting Christian nationalism. If you haven't already, sign up for our weekly bonus content and ad-free listening at accessmundi.us. LFG, folks. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Thomas Paine wrote that. I'm recording this at 9 p.m. Eastern on Tuesday, March 4th. Things may have changed, and if that rings a bell, it's because Donald Trump is addressing Congress right now, and rather than watch that shit show, I am gonna sit here and talk to you about what he has done so far. And we have a lot to cover in this Trump roundup. So I need to issue a disclaimer here right up front for you, because this is not going to be exhaustive. This is not going to get to every single thing he has done, nor would you want it to. You don't have the time, and more to the point, our brains are not evolved enough to handle this kind of volume of bad news. Truly. Most of you are listening because you know about the books that I wrote about religion and the law and history, or maybe my professional work with Americans United for Separation of Church and State, or maybe my work with the Freedom From Religion Foundation, or that I volunteer with the Secular Students, or my atheism, or all of the above. But before that, I got a Bachelor of Science, a BS in both environmental science and neuroscience. And so when I say that your brain does not have the capacity to deal with the flood of information that it is encountering right now, I mean just that. I hinted at this in the first episode. Really, we are not able to cope, literally. But your brain is also wired to seek out bad news. Why? Because it helps you be prepared. If you know where the danger is, the predators hunt over there, the poisonous plants grow over there, that water is not potable, you survive and pass that yearning for preparedness on. This is partly why you doom scroll. The other part is because we are addicted to our devices. And both of those are unhealthy. It's not just the sheer number of stories, but as a recent Scientific American article explains, it's also the emotional weight of these stories. Think about USAID and the fact that these cuts are going to kill and starve children around the world. The emotional weight of that story is almost impossible for us to bear. It feels like a tidal wave, explains Danigal Young, a professor at the University of Delaware, and you can't, quote, push back against a tidal wave. our biological capacity simply is not there. They know this. They may not know the actual biology or the neuroscience, but they know it works. This is Steve Bannon's strategy.
I said, all we have to do is flood the zone. Every day we hit them with three things. They'll bite on one and we'll get all of our stuff done. Bang, bang, bang. These guys will never be able to recover. But we got to start with muzzle velocity. So it's got to start and it's got to hammer.
What was
the
word?
Muzzle velocity. Uh-huh.
So we can't focus on everything. They know it. They take advantage of it. So as we go through this, you know there is more. You know there is worse than what I will cover today. That is just the world that we live in now. And honestly, it always probably was to a certain extent. We're going to spend most of our time looking at the executive orders because that's most of what Trump has done. We're going to look closely at a couple, especially the Faith Office, and then we will see where this rant takes me. I've got a few things we might get into, time permitting. The main two areas where Trump has worked so far are on these executive orders and foreign policy. There hasn't been any real legislation. There has been no real rulemaking. Rulemaking is where agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency or the Department of Health and Human Services, these federal government agencies, the Department of Education, right, where we have all these secretaries, where they make rules and regulations that actually impact your everyday life. It's the grind of administrative law, and there's a whole procedure you have to go through, and Trump doesn't seem interested in really doing much of that, though he does seem interested in gutting the federal government instead of doing that rulemaking. So no real legislation, no real rulemaking. It's really all executive orders and foreign policy. Why? Why not go for that legislation? Why not go for that rulemaking? Especially the legislation. He has Congress, and we're going to get into his absurd, big, beautiful bill in a minute. I think it's because he's weak. He's as spineless as Rubio sinking into that couch in the Oval Office. But why not try to make real lasting change instead of these ephemeral executive orders that can be overturned by the next person in line? And that often, if you actually get into, as we will in a little bit, some of the verbiage, pretty minimal. We'll see just how minimal when we look at the Anti-Christian Bias Task Force. He has both chambers of Congress. Why not pass some laws? Could it be overcompensating? You know, even the supposed strong man, this guy who claims to have total power over his party, who embarrasses and belittles any Republican dissidents because he can't convince his most loyal supporters to get together long enough to pass legislation? That even he is weak in this arena? So you have this flood of executive orders that make Trump seem strong and powerful, but they might really be a confession of weakness. And I have no doubt that the unilateral action of an executive order makes him feel more powerful without realizing how weak they are. I don't think he's reading a lot of these. He has revoked something like 100 or so of Biden's executive orders. So I think the why is that he probably can't pass legislation through Congress yet. He is trying to pass one big budget bill, and it has passed the House so far, but it barely squeaked through the House. 217 to 215, that was the vote. And a special, huge, amazing shout out to U.S. Representative Brittany Pederson, who represents Colorado's beautiful 7th Congressional District. She flew in for the vote from maternity leave, voting with her 4-week-old son in her arms against this bill that will tax all of us to give more money to the uber wealthy. I mean, women are badasses.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I rise today with my newborn, Sam, who's just 4 weeks old. Unfortunately, I wasn't given the opportunity to vote remotely after giving birth, but I wasn't going to let that stop me from being here to represent my constituents and vote no on this disastrous Republican budget proposal.
They had to delay the vote, actually, because the Republicans didn't have the votes to pass this. So they actually delayed it, and Trump got on the phone and had to bully some of the holdouts. And since they passed it, there's already more disagreement in the GOP. There's some people who want more. There's some people who want less. And then this all has to be reconciled with what comes out of the Senate. And they have to negotiate on those details before it then goes to the erratic, mercurial, volatile Donald Trump. Politico reported on March 3rd, quote, Senate GOP leadership staffers indicated to rank and file GOP offices Monday that they aren't even close to resolving Senate demands on the House budget plan. So legislation just may not be possible for this inept leader. So we're going to talk about the orders, the executive orders, because again, outside of the foreign policy debacles and embarrassments, that's really all he's done. And the debacles and embarrassments do not seem to be thought through. They do not seem to be part of a larger strategy. They just seem to be the whim and fancy and really emotional reaction of Donald Trump and J.D. Vance. And of course, our shadow president, Elon Musk. Now, just a few of those orders, again, not all of the orders. We've got citizenship orders, we've got DEI orders, immigration, we've got orders targeting LGBTQ plus people, especially trans people, and in particular, trans women. The birthright citizenship order, tons on immigration, really working on making this into a white Christian nation through using executive orders. We've got a few orders specifically targeting transgender people, the housing of transgender inmates, the ban on transgender individuals serving in the military, the ban on gender-affirming care for individuals under the age of 18, the ban on transgender athletes in women's sports. The passport policy targeting transgender people, would that they spent as much time targeting infectious diseases that can be prevented with vaccines. Now, Trump can say whatever he wants about civil rights and LGBTQ rights and discrimination, but the reality is that the federal courts are going to get a final say over a lot of that. And that, of course, Congress has a role to play too. The point is that these executive orders are important, but they are by no means permanent. And they're not as impactful as other moves he might make. And a part of that is because the courts are going to have their say. There are 96 cases challenging various executive actions so far, and that's according to the Just Security Tracker. Great website. Highly recommend if you're into the legal nuts and bolts and nerdery. And by my quick count beforehand, it looks like there are 17 wins in those cases. Now, these are not permanent wins. These are temporary restraining orders or preliminary injunctions. In a couple cases, they are opinions coming from the court. So these are temporary wins. And then, of course, they are temporary also in the sense that they might be appealed and overturned later. So that 17 is by no means rock solid, nor is it going to stay that way. And it is in the legal arena, our courts of law, that there is a coming clash. And you're hearing it referred to as a constitutional crisis. And you heard Annika Brockschmidt mention this in the first episode. You've heard Bradley talk about it on Straight White American Jesus. The reality is that we crossed into the territory of constitutional crisis a long time ago. Really, that Rubicon was crossed back in 2015. When Mitch McConnell unilaterally announced that he was going to block any Supreme Court appointment that Barack Obama, then president, made, even though it was more than a year out from the next president taking office. And then we have Leonard Leo, beginning back then, spending more than $500 million that we know about capturing the Supreme Court. Leonard Leo bought one branch of our government, a branch with lifetime appointments, in Trump's first term. And much of what we are dealing with now traces back to that capture. This court has immunized presidential lawlessness with its utterly despicable decision in the immunity case, Trump versus U.S. I was actually wondering late last night if I was misremembering how bad that decision was, thinking about this episode, planning it out in my head, and wondering, was it as bad as I remember because it was raw? And I went back and skimmed it. And no, it is that bad. It is a terrible, terrible decision. But the court has been defying history and precedent and the rule of law for really close to 20 years, as I documented in American Crusade. That case, other cases, Citizens United to Dobbs to the immunity decision to whatever damage they're going to do this term. This is the constitutional crisis. The John Roberts Court is the constitutional crisis. The Leonard Leo captured court. This is the crisis, the court itself. Because the court has been captured, hijacked, fucked. We have to unfuck the court. If we ever want to climb out of this hole, to right this ship, to make progress down the correct path, we must unfuck the court. This is a prerequisite to everything else. We could do everything else right. We could win elections in landslides. We could expand the franchise. We could create new civil rights regimes to attain that aspirational value of equality that is written into our Constitution, and then this court will come along and fuck it all up in one term. We must unfuck the court. So the crisis is already here. And it has been. What people mean when they are talking about the constitutional crisis right now is that it's coming to a head, that we are on the verge of a clash of powers that are meant to be separated. The clash is whether or not these politicians like Musk and Trump and Vance will obey courts and judges striking down and reversing their orders or reversing Elon Musk's tweets or Trump's whims. This is the coming clash that people are talking about and worried about. It's a constitutional crisis already because the court has empowered that kind of lawlessness through its previous decisions, because it has been captured to empower that kind of lawlessness. And they're coming after these judges. Musk tweeted, "A corrupt judge protecting corruption. He needs to be impeached now." J.D. Vance tweeted, now infamously, "If a judge tried to tell a general how to conduct a military operation, that would be illegal. If a judge tried to command the attorney general and how to use her discretion as a prosecutor, that's also illegal. Judges aren't allowed to control the executive's legitimate power." Yeah, they are allowed to strike down its illegitimate power. And then you have Donald Trump.
"No judge should frankly be allowed to make that kind of a decision. It's a disgrace."
And of course, the fascists have their bootlickers. Senator Tom Cotton tweeted that it was outrageous Obama judge Paul Engelmeyer didn't just bar Elon Musk and Doge from Treasury systems. He barred the Secretary of the Treasury himself without citing a single law. "This outlaw should be reversed immediately, and Engelmeyer should be forbidden by higher courts from ever hearing another case against the Trump administration." Representative Daryl Issa of California, Republican, introduced the No Rogue Rulings Act. Basically, it would say no more nationwide injunctions from a district court. Now, this cuts both ways. We can think about abortion. That might have been a nice thing to have. And there actually is a way to do this. You change the law. And this is something that some of us suggested as a fix worth exploring, along with jurisdiction stripping, taking other cases away from the courts, back when Biden had power. And this is something that the Dems kind of always miss. They explore and they have these tentative conversations, right? Think about Biden's Blue Ribbon Supreme Court commission. They have these tentative conversations about things like judicial reform or fixing the Supreme Court, and then they fail to take action. And then when the Republicans take power, they do take action, and they can point to those conversations. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself, and I'm getting up on my soapbox, and I'm going to pull myself down. Flood that I talked about is not just about overwhelming you. It's also about testing the fences while you're being overwhelmed. They are pushing the limits to see what they can do, what they can get away with. And that's why the courts being in crisis is such a problem right now. They are raptors testing the fences. So what happens when they break through? What will the judges do to respond? What happens if and when Elon Musk, who is apparently a government employee, who knows, it's not clear, maybe appointed, we're not sure. What happens when Elon Musk defies a court order? Well, it's kind of already happening, but this is the clash that people are really worried about, and rightfully so. Judge Amir Ali is hearing a few cases challenging the indiscriminate freeze on all foreign aid that's making U.S. default on contracts and is starving kids abroad. AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition versus the State Department and Global Health Council versus Trump. So Trump basically indiscriminately ended all aid, and Judge Ali issued a temporary restraining order against the indiscriminate end of all aid. But Rubio and the State Department have basically ignored it, claiming that all the aid in question fell under this one tiny narrow exception that the judge wrote into his order. This was bullshit, as a whistleblower explained. So what did Judge Ali do? What could he do? And this is where we're getting to the rub. He took the least harsh, least confrontational road, the option that was least likely to escalate things. He rewrote his temporary restraining order so that they couldn't use that one narrow exception. But what if it happens again? What if they do escalate it? What if they try to ignore the temporary restraining order again? What can judges do? Well, they can hold people who violate their orders in contempt, throw them in jail. They can give them fines. They can escalate the fines, right? And that is what is going to be the breaking point for our democracy. That clash, and when a judge finally asks to escalate to that level, because if they don't, their orders are pointless anyway. So is this likely? That's the question. And when Donald Trump redecorated the Oval Office, which every president gets to do when they take power, he put in a portrait of a president that he presumably admires, Andrew Jackson. I don't know how much Trump knows about history, but I think it's a safe presumption to say that he admires the man whose portrait he put in the Oval Office. The thing that Jackson is perhaps most known for today, or one of the things for which he is most known, is his defiance of Chief Justice John Marshall. Marshall was deciding a somewhat convoluted case about the sovereignty of Native American tribes. And after he decides this case, the Supreme Court decides it, Jackson supposedly said, "John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it." There are very good reasons to think that this quote is apocryphal or fabricated, not least of which is because it didn't appear until 20 years after Jackson's death. But the point is not whether the quote is true, but that Jackson is known for saying it. And of course, we know that Trump and his cronies are nothing if not fans of fabricated quotes from the founding-ish generation. So Jackson is known for having said it, whether he did or not. And the hanging of that portrait, along with everything else that we know about Trump, is almost certainly a good indicator of where we are going. Okay, let's talk about one of the executive orders I am hearing the most about. From people on social media, from journalist friends, one of the orders that I'm getting the most questions about, understandably so, is the Faith Office. Now, Trump claimed this was a brand new office, but it's not. I'm not sure what he's getting at there. President George W. Bush created the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives on January 29th, 2001. He signed Executive Order 13199, and he created this office to funnel taxpayer money to churches and religious organizations in violation of the Constitution. Oh, and to reward his political supporters. How do I know? Well, we all know this because Bush's deputy director of that office, the late David Kuo, who was an evangelical Christian, left the office disenchanted and wrote a tell-all book entitled Tempting Faith. And Kuo tells of an office that was all about rewarding political allies, not about supporting charity and good works and the organizations doing good works. Quote, "It couldn't have been clearer that the White House needed the faith-based initiative because it had the potential to successfully evangelize more voters than any other." They're talking about evangelizing voters. And the office actually held events for embattled Republican candidates with faith leaders. And where those events were held, those embattled candidates won 19 out of the 20 races. And when it did come to actually engaging in charitable work, right? So the idea was this office would fund charitable work. Groups would apply for grants, for money, and then they would turn around and do good work with it. But Kuo quotes one grant officer who was in charge of deciding who's going to get that money. This is what the officer said, quote, "When I saw one of those non-Christian groups in the set I was reviewing, I just stopped looking at them and gave them a zero. A lot of us did." Bush used this office to compensate, not just to rally, to compensate financially his supporters and the organizations that got the vote out for him, those evangelical Christians. Over the years, especially under Obama and Biden, the office had broader goals and often was not just partnering with churches, but also, as the name indicated, neighborhood organizations. Now, Trump has specifically renamed it the Faith Office, as if to wipe out the non-religious aspect. That's what it says in the title of the executive order. But if you read the order itself, it actually is more expansive and does include some of that neighborhood language. So this seems more like a titular reward to his fervent supporters, something that they can point to and say, see, look what he did for us, even though it maybe isn't as much. But the office has another problem that is historically kind of a big deal, and a big deal if you care about your own religious freedom. Giving government money to a religious organization is unconstitutional. Doing this violates the separation of church and state. Now, the Supreme Court has decided otherwise, but we just talked about the Supreme Court's problems. And groups were actually successfully challenging this office at every turn because it was unconstitutionally doling out millions of dollars to churches and religious organizations, oftentimes to do religious work. In lawsuit after lawsuit, these groups were successful. They stopped millions of dollars from unconstitutionally flowing to what amounted to state-sanctioned religion. So what happened? Well, in 2007, the Supreme Court stepped in and said, nope, taxpayers have no legal right to challenge funds spent by the executive branch in almost every case, even if that expenditure violates the Constitution. The legal term of art they use here is standing. People had no standing to challenge these grants. The other big problem with this office that Trump has created, and it's a particular problem with Trump, but it's especially a problem given the history, is the grift. Again, this is an office that was created to reward political allies in churches and funnel money their way. People who worked in that office told us as much. Now, this president is a notorious grifter, and he has appointed a prosperity gospel preacher who is an expert at enriching herself at the expense of her congregation to run that office. As far as I'm concerned, the prosperity gospel is spiritual blackmail. Thanks for listening to the free version of today's episode. To get the whole conversation, unfiltered and unfettered, sign up at accessmundi.us. Costs less than that latte you bought on the way to work, and I am just as delicious. Signing up also gets you premium content from Straight White American Jesus and other Access Mundi shows. Try it. You can always change your mind because life is too good to waste on bad ideas. This has been One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew Seidel. Until next time.